On Friday night, rain will turn heavy as it spreads across northwest Scotland, with gales developing. The clearest, coldest weather will be across the southern half of England and Wales, with some ground frost by Saturday morning. On Saturday, a weakening band of rain will move south across Scotland, Northern Ireland, into northern England and North Wales, brightening up behind it ahead of it staying dry and bright. On Sunday, further rain and wind in northwest Scotland, slowly moving south. Elsewhere, it'll be a fine, dry day. And that's the forecast. I'll hand you back to Steve Urquhart.
Nick, thanks very much. So now let's return to Thomas Brothers' account of Louis Armstrong's early years in Louis Armstrong, Master of Modernism. It's read by Colin McFarlane.
Louis Armstrong. Who is he? Wrote a Chicago journalist in The Defender. He is the jazz cornet king, and he just got in from old New York, where he left him sad on account of his departure. Louis is the feature man now in his wife Lil's jazz band at the Dreamland. I'm surprised he hasn't named himself King Louis. December 1925. Armstrong was now cast as a local rather than as an immigrant from the South. The Defender article was headed, Home at Last. In the months after his return from New York, he made his mark at the two premier entertainment venues for African Americans in Chicago, the Dreamland Cafe and at the Vendome Theater. He would continue at the Vendome for another 2 years, with time off for one brief vacation and not much more. This was where he achieved his status in Black Chicago as one of the leading singers and cornet players on the scene. And significantly, for the first time, the priority between the two talents is not clear. His activity extended to recording albums, making his legendary Hot 5 series, with a group, including his wife, formed not as a working band, but purely for the purpose of recording. He was taking center stage. No longer a dash of variety in a fancy orchestra or a background support to famous blues singers.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, we have a little novelty for you this evening.
That was Armstrong's promise to his audience. Like sex appeal, novelty is a timeless commodity, but it had special resonance in the 1920s, a period of great inventions. In those crazy days, the sensation-hungry public was ready for a new fad every 24 hours, said fellow musician Mez Mesereau. In music, this could range from animal imitations to all kinds of physical displays, playing three clarinets at once, playing the bass while lying down, shimmying the stomach muscles while playing the drums, or trotting out a 4-foot coach trumpet. Novelty was central to Armstrong's innovative playing and crowd appeal. Louis has promised to give the Chicago public some new figures in jazz, wrote one critic in 1926, as he has had ample time to figure out some eccentric ones. The great swing pianist Teddy Wilson defined eccentric music thus. When I say eccentric, I mean getting away from straight 4-4 rhythm. Armstrong was leading the way in this, influencing many other great musicians of the day. The pianist Earl Hines, for example, is sometimes said to play trumpet-style piano, in recognition of Armstrong's influence. Virtually all programs in cabarets and theaters featured variety acts, different kinds of performers following one another in rapid succession. And within each performance, too, there had to be a flow of continuously fresh details. Performers who were good at generating a lot of ideas had an advantage, and no one was better at this than Armstrong. Speed may have been more important than anything else. The entire decade embraced it, through cultural and technological inventions. Behold now the days of super speed, of super brilliance, of super power, wrote the Chicago Daily News. Speed shaped entertainment of all kinds. Speed up is the present-day slogan, agreed a show columnist. Step on it, jazz it up, snap to it, are familiar exclamations. Performers ended on the previous act's exit, or even before its finish, avoiding any lull. Armstrong was thoroughly caught up in the race. Entertainers often integrated comedy into their routines, as audiences began to think, a show without a comedian is no show at all. Earl Hines agreed. The Negro comedians were very successful.
Their funny comments on everyday life and on what happened in the Southland were all mixed up with reference to segregation that were particularly amusing to us Negroes who knew what it was all about. It was a relief from the distress and the turmoil we always had, and that's where a lot of that great soul feeling came from.
One of the oldest surviving documents associated with Armstrong is his copy of a comedy skit called The Boy from Gaffney, Alabama. It will be hard to overestimate the extent of humor in his vocal music. His two big hits of 1926, Heebie Jeebies and Big Butter and Eggman, were pure cabaret-style comedy. And with this, he became more popular every night and was the talk of Chicago. A clipping from a newspaper preserved in a scrapbook by Lil confirms it. Louis Armstrong, the greatest jazz cornet player in the country, is drawing in the crowds in Dreamland nightly to hear him blast out those weird, crazy figures. This boy is in a class by himself. Soon after his name lit up the Dreamland marquee, conductor Erskine Tate invited him to join the Vendome Theater Symphony Orchestra. This was an upscale movie house on State Street. He accepted, but the prospect was terrifying. Tate's outfit may have been the most sophisticated African-American orchestra in the country.
"I'd like to have fainted," he recalled. His wife scolded him. "Boy, if you don't get out this house and go on down there to rehearsal, I'll skin you alive."
It turned out to be a good move.
"It was my greatest experience of them all," he wrote later. "I wouldn't take a million for that experience."
If you wanted to hear African-American musicians playing the finest classical music at the highest technical level, you headed to the Vendome in Chicago, no matter where you lived. Like Lillian Armstrong and Fletcher Henderson, Tate's background was strictly classical. When Louis joined him, he was at the top of his game. Though jazz in its various forms was gaining popularity, he and other theater musicians with no background in improvised music hardly felt threatened. They were secure in their niche, but theaters were now trying to embrace the principle of variety while keeping a classical spin. Tate wanted to broaden his appeal, keeping enough people happy to fill up the Vendome and giving all the patrons, including a younger crowd, what they wanted. Tate's brother James occupied the first trumpet chair. With Louis playing the cornet and James sitting next to him with the longer trumpet, well, it just didn't look good.
"You look funny there with your stubby little cornet," Tate joked.
It took Louis a little while to get used to a new horn, but such were the demands of a symphony orchestra. It was quite a leap to join Tate.
"I couldn't read music like a lot of them cats, but I was never embarrassed in music with bands because I'd state my case. I'd say, 'Now I can blow, and you give me elbow room, you're going to have a nice time, but don't put me to no tests.'"
At the Vendome, he advanced to the point where he could read music fluently. There was no room for faking.
"If a musician couldn't read there, he was lost, didn't have any job."
In his later career, Armstrong never flaunted this ability, even kept it somewhat hidden, as did other African-American musicians, who understood that white audiences at the time liked to think of them as primitive and illiterate. Tate's orchestra became the pride of the race and the pets of Chicago's music lovers. The Vendome was all about status for the black audience, but you didn't have to be rich to buy a ticket. It only took 10 cents to enter a lovely theater where everyone was dressed up and intent on enjoying an evening of first-rate music, comedy, and dancing, with a movie and newsreel to boot. It's easy to see how in a theater like this, African-American entertainers had special value, for the simple reason that the movies themselves weren't made with them in mind. Movies rarely included black actors, and when they did, the characters were treated with condescension and contempt. How much better to see a flashy dancer, a smooth singer, a fancy cornet solo, and the finest race orchestra in the country, all of it black, all of it classy. Even if the movie was racist and degrading, the live program assured the black audience that their race was doing just fine. Another special part of Armstrong's Vendome experience was that he made his name as a singer there. He liked to point out that he was a singer before he ever touched a cornet, first in church, and then in a barbershop quartet with his friends as a boy. But for years, it had taken a back seat. Now he sang with great success, and from here on in, his singing and trumpet playing would stand alongside each other.
She lived to Georgia crying. Yes, sir, she went crazy about the Georgia crying. You know what they, everybody crying. She do the Georgia crying.
The legendary jazz bass player, Milt Hinton, saw the Vendome scene in a way that opens up a deeper understanding of Armstrong's accomplishment there.
People would come on Sundays to the theater and they'd be dressed fine, having on their tuxedos with the roll collars, and it was like, you know, like white folks, like it was a big white theater, because they thought this was the way it was supposed to be. This was a very conditioned thing that had been brought down to us that the white way was the only way. And we'd sit and listen to this classy orchestra play, and then, why, then Louis stood up and played one of his great solos, and you could see everybody just letting their hair down like, yeah, that's the way it should be. This is it. This is what really relates to us.
To some, it must have seemed like destiny that music would carry the burden of defining the new African-American identity during those optimistic years.
Looking back, our people have been so browbeaten that they were nothing. They really believed that.
Hinton went on.
My mother accepted this inferiority while trying to get me not to accept it.
She chose music lessons as the path to respect for her son. She wanted him to be good enough to play professionally, so she took him to the Vendome, where he could see some black people that were really making a success of it. Even if the audiences had not been looking for a modern black identity, Armstrong was now making that impossible to ignore. His music was brimming with black vernacular and placed a high value on improvisation. Years later, Malcolm X noted how white people danced as though somebody had trained them. Left, 1, 2. Right, 3, 4. The same steps over and over. For those Negroes, nobody in the world could have choreographed the way they did whatever they felt. In the 20s, improvisation was becoming seen as a marker of black sophistication and virtuosity. Musical details were bound up with values that go beyond music. Trombonist Preston Jackson was asked what he liked about Armstrong during these years and said,
"Well, the thing that impressed me even more than the music was his bearing. That was his way he carried himself, like somebody bragging and all, saying, 'Look, I am good.' To my mind, it is the duty of the younger Negro artist to change, through the force of his art, that old whispering, 'I want to be white,'" wrote the African-American poet and activist, Langston Hughes.
And that is precisely what Armstrong did. He selectively folded white standards into his vernacular shape vision. He was, in Hughes's words, "not afraid to be himself." No one could have imagined how profoundly this would radiate out past the Vendome, out of Chicago, across the country, and across oceans. His local transformation of an African-American audience's sense of who they were became a global regard for new possibilities through music.
Tomorrow, Louis befriends Al Capone. Colin McFarlane was reading from Louis Armstrong, Master of Modernism by Thomas Brothers. The book's abridged by Eileen Horn, produced by Clive Brill, and it's a Pacificus production for BBC Radio 4. Now from Pacificus to the Atlanticus. Thank you. This is BBC Radio 4. And now the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on Friday the 11th of April. There are warnings of gales in Rockall, Hebrides, Bailey, Fair Isle, Faroes and Southeast Iceland. The general synopsis at 1800, high 350 miles west of Fitzroy, 1029, slow moving, declining 1027 by 1800 Friday. New low